This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
At Sephora, we know how you love to use makeup, skincare, hair care, and fragrances that work for you, but also how important it is to be in the know about the ingredients that are in them, which is why we created Clean at Sephora. Curated products from brands like Merit, Amika, Summer Fridays, and Fleur that have everything you want, minus certain ingredients you might not. Clean at Sephora is only at Sephora. Shop now at Sephora.com.
Rational debate, cogent analysis, bipartisan solutions. Welcome to this edition of The Politics Guys.
I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. With me this week is my regular co-host, Jay Carson, Cleveland area attorney with decades of experience in the trenches of Republican politics. How are you doing this week, Jay?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. You know, before we get to our first story, there are a few little administrative things I just wanted to take care of. First off, those of you who have listened to the show more than once, you might notice that there was something new, a new theme with no music, a lot shorter, and there's a little bit of a story behind this. I listen to a lot of podcasts. And so in thinking about a new theme, and there were a lot of listeners who say your old theme is just so incredibly dull and we want something new. Well, I thought about how
my kids wanted to go back to the love of the government, but
you know, exactly. But there were other people who said, is this really in fitting with what you're doing, the sort of vibe you're trying to,
and it's a little aggressive, I thought
those exactly. And so I thought those were reasonable points as well. So we came up with this. And, you know, I thought sort of in terms of how I view podcast intros, they're kind of like clever voicemail messages. You know, they're clever once or twice. But after that, you're just, oh, God, can we just please skip this thing and move along? And so I actually thought about maybe we should try no intro. But one of our board members pointed out, you know, it's important to let first-time listeners know what we're all about and what we try to do. And so I thought this was sort of the best of all worlds, and I really like it. But the main thing, of course, is how you feel about it. So please, folks, let us know, good, bad, or indifferent. And again, you can just get in touch with us, mail@politicsguys.com. Let us know what you think about the new minimalist intro. All right, second thing. This week, I was a special co-host, I guess you could say, on the 45th podcast. I joined Arabia and Susan to talk about the NRA, CPAC, the Mueller investigation, and that memo from the House Democrats on the Intelligence Committee. It was a lot of fun. It was different for me, but I really enjoyed it. It's part of a host exchange thing we're doing with the 45th. In fact, someone from the 45th will be coming to our show probably sometime in, I guess, late March, I think is what we're shooting for. So if you're interested in hearing that, you can check it out at their website. It's 45th.com. That's 45th.com, or you can just search for the 45th podcast on iTunes, Pocket Cast, Spotify, or, you know, whatever you use to listen to podcasts. And finally, this last week, I had something of an ongoing Twitter feud with one of our longest standing and most loyal fans, Eric, over the comments I made.
It ain't so.
You know, it's true. I get some flack too. It's not all you, Jay. You might recall, Jay, that I made some comments about Wayne LaPierre.
Yes.
I basically said he was either a fool or a knave for saying those, what I thought were ridiculously inflammatory things about how liberals don't care about kids. And Eric suggested that I was being completely blind on this issue and I hadn't called out liberals who made similar statements. And I said to Eric, well, if you can find a liberal who made a similar statement of similar stature, I will call this person out at the very top of the show. And Eric sent me something about the governor of Connecticut saying that Republicans have blood on their hands. Now, I don't think that's hugely inflammatory and unhelpful. I don't know that it's quite at the same level of, you know, liberals don't care about kids, but point taken.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I think that's actually it's more inflammatory, I think.
Well, in any case, that's maybe a small difference. But the point being is that's exactly the kind of inflammatory rhetoric that I think is completely unhelpful. And I think it was shameful for Connecticut's governor to say that. And so there you go, Eric. I hope you now believe that I am not completely close-minded and blinded on this issue. So I am bipartisan in terms of being against ridiculously inflammatory rhetoric. So there we go. All right. So, for our first story today, President Trump shocked, well, I guess just about everyone except Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, when late this week he announced plans to impose tariffs of 25% on imported steel and 10% on imported aluminum. Now, the administration says doing this doesn't violate international trade agreements. They cited a trade law provision allowing for the imposition of tariffs for national security purposes. And many U.S. trading partners disagree with this, and they'll certainly be challenging the move as well as retaliating by imposing their own tariffs on U.S. goods. And this announcement disturbed a lot of Republican legislators. There are a couple of comments that I thought were fairly indicative of how a lot of Republicans felt. Utah's Orrin Hatch said, "Tariffs are taxes paid by American businesses and American families, and new tariffs would jeopardize some of the opportunities we successfully created through tax reform." Then there was Pennsylvania's Senator Pat Toomey, who said tariffs would be very bad for consumers, would raise costs for all kinds of products, would destroy more jobs than they save, and would invite retaliation from other countries. Well, of course, Donald Trump couldn't let that be. He needed to respond. And so he tweeted, "When a country, USA, is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win. Example, when we are down $100 billion with a certain country and they get cute, don't trade anymore. We win big. It's easy." So, Jay, what do you think? Is this an easy big win, as President Trump seems to think?
No, I would say for all of the folks who have been after me for saying I'm some sort of in the bag for Donald Trump, or a Trump apologist, or I should be auditioned for to be the next Trump spokesperson. This is your day. This is the sort of disaster that troubled me and many conservatives from the beginning of the Trump campaign. The hope was that this was simply campaign rhetoric and he wasn't actually going to do anything. Now it seems he is actually going to do something, unless he is somehow dissuaded by a lot of the prominent Republicans who have spoken out against this. I think you're going to see a lot more of folks in industry speaking out against this. The stock markets have spoken out against this, bigly, you might say. So to me, this is really troubling. And I share the frustrations of Orrin Hatch and Pat Toomey in that of all the economic progress that has been made, through things like deregulation and tax reform, this puts them in jeopardy. Now the good news, bad news. I mean, I think the bad news is he's thinking about doing this. My sense is that he has the authority to do this. Now whether other countries may cry foul under the agreements and seek retribution, I mean, I think that's what many of them are going to do. The good news is this is something that can be undone quickly. If need be, and hopefully he will come to his senses. But, and Mike, we've talked about this.
Before we move on, yeah. I just want to point the "and hopefully he will come to his senses" comment. Now, it seems to me that if one thing we know about Donald Trump is that he does not back down, he doubles down in the face of criticism. And so it seems to me, while I would like to believe that this is a possibility that he would back off of this position, given the criticism he's gotten from it, my sense of who he is psychologically, emotionally, is that's likely to just have him get his back up and be less likely to pull back on that.
That could be true.
I hope it's not.
Yeah, I hope it not. I hope it's not. I mean, my guess, though, is with this, it's not simply going to be criticism that he's receiving. there's going to be data, and that's in terms of things like the stock market, in terms of what other costs that other manufacturers are paying. For example, automakers, really, I mean, just about anyone. I mean, it's such a strange, and I should highlight how very un-Republican this type of move is. You know, we talk occasionally, we go back to the, we go old school and talk about Adam Smith and so forth. And Adam Smith's big idea, and he's often credited as being sort of the founder of modern capitalism. But what he was talking about wasn't even so much of as capitalism as an economic system for a country. His Wealth of Nations was about free trade. And it was about the idea that, you know, it benefits everyone. For those countries to do what they do best, and those manufacturers and producers to do what they do best, and to have a freedom of trade back and forth, and it lifts all boats, and it moves progress forward. So that has been sort of at the heart of sort of Republican economic theory for you know, two centuries now, and really I think, and I've always, I mean, you can make the argument that, I mean, it's it's not coincidental that the Wealth of the Nations was published in 1776. It's sort of the same vibe, the same feel that inspired our Declaration of Independence and our founding documents. There was this sense of liberality, both politically and in economics, that was sweeping the globe. I'm entirely flummoxed that Trump is doing this. I'm hoping that Republicans will step up and condemn this. It's interesting the Democrat buy-in though too already. But
there's some, yeah, absolutely, and it's because of course there are some Democrats who would like to see more tariffs and trade restrictions and that sort of thing, and that's where I disagree.
And the idea being it's protectionism that in many cases protects union jobs.
Yeah, but and, you know, let's look at this. You know, the Trump administration cited national security. This is an exception that's never been invoked since the WTO came into existence, and the idea that this is has anything to do with national security is, well, in the words of the Wall Street Journal, it's preposterous. You know, more than or right around 70% of steel in the United States is United States steel. So the idea that there's some kind of great threat, you can make maybe a slightly better case with aluminum, but still our biggest, we get most of our aluminum from Canada, you know, the evil threat to the North right. From national security. And so this is just, you know, this is just ridiculous. And in terms of the effect on jobs, this is also really obvious. The Aluminum Association pointed out that only 3% of the total aluminum industry jobs are in actually aluminum smelting, creating aluminum. The other 97% are in those downstream industries. I mean, it's a similar thing with steel. Steel using industries, according to the Wall Street Journal, again, employ around 6.5 million people. The steel making industry, around 140,000. And, you know, this to me, this doesn't surprise me, because one issue that Donald Trump has been consistent on for a long time, one issue where I believe he has a strong policy view, is in trade, in being anti-free trade, I would say. You know, I think he has this nostalgic view of the 1950s and 60s, when in places like Pittsburgh and Youngstown, the steel plants were going, you know, full bore and heavy American manufacturing. But
I'm very familiar with the steel nostalgia. Yeah.
Yeah, of course you would, given where you grew up. But that world is gone, and the idea that trying to get that world back is a fool's errand, and you know, and that's why I just think this is just a disastrous policy, and I don't think it. I think it's going to happen, and I just think it's going to be up to the next president to bring some common sense to bear on this.
Well, you know, other thoughts? I think the nostalgia thing. Yeah, I think that plays. And Jonah Goldberg had a really great piece in his newsletter, the G-Files, which if you're into that kind of thing and you like the Jonah Goldberg approach, which is sort of my approach in a lot of ways. There was a time, Mike, when you thought I was secretly Jonah Goldberg.
Yes. No, I'll tell you, folks, if Jay were to write a weekly column, it would look very much like Jonah Goldberg. So if you can't get enough of Jay, sign up for Jonah Goldberg's column. I read it every week. I disagree with him a lot, but it's a great read. So
he's even more entertaining than I am.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far.
but no, the idea of nostalgia that we're going to become this great industry and employ all these thousands and thousands of people in the steelmaking industry. That, you know, in part, the reason that doesn't happen is because technology has advanced so much. We don't need to employ that many people in these industries. We can make as much steel, if not more steel, cheaper than we could in those days. We can make it cheaper. We can make it cleaner. I think you're exactly right. I mean, he's hearkening back to a world that just doesn't exist anymore. My hope is that either cooler heads will prevail before he moves forward with this, or the response in terms of industry and retaliation from other countries will be such that he realizes that this was a bad path and he will find some sort of an exit ramp.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, before I move on, one thing on that topic of nostalgia I wanted to mention, I've been meaning to mention this for a while now. I'm in the middle of reading a great book on this topic, this kind of nostalgia that really both parties feel for the past and are trying to sort of recreate this America of the 1950s and 60s, at least in terms of economics. And it's called The Fractured Republic by a guy named Yuval Levin, who's a conservative writer, but he has a certain, I would call it intellectual humility and open-mindedness that I find refreshing and great. And he's a super smart guy, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes, but it's definitely worth reading.
I'm a big Levin fan.
Yes. Yeah, he's a great guy.
I haven't read the book, but yes, I like all his other stuff.
All right, well, moving on. It's been another busy week in firearms policy in the wake of that February 14th mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. Congressional Republicans seem to be directing a lot of the focus on what they see as a grossly inadequate response by local law enforcement as well as the FBI. And I think they've also somewhat coalesced around the Fix Nix bill, which would strengthen that background check system. Now, Democrats are arguing that these measures don't go far enough and are calling for things like mandatory background checks for private gun sales, raising the age for buying weapons from 18 to 21, which is a proposal that has some Republican buy-in as well. And many Democrats, though, are also calling for outright bans on the sale of assault-style weapons and high-capacity magazines. And these are measures that are highly unlikely, I'd say, to get serious legislative consideration in any Republican-controlled Congress. Now, in that televised meeting with lawmakers that President Trump had this week, he seems to like these things, I would say it's fair to say that he shocked and dismayed many of his fellow Republicans by calling for tougher legislation than many of them are comfortable with, accusing them of being petrified, in his word, by the NRA. He said, "We want to pass something great. And to me, the something great has to be where we prevent it from happening again." Yeah, he never said, "We want to press something, you know, decent." And he also suggested that due process really wasn't much of a concern, saying, "Take the guns first, go through due process second," which to me at least indicates kind of a fundamental lack of understanding as to what due process actually means. So, Jay, what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, A couple of things. I think, you know, we talked about last week, I think the areas where there are agreement, things like bump stocks, I think that's sort of a no-brainer. I think that will get done in some way, shape, or form. I think the fix the background checks, Democrats are going to be at a disadvantage on this issue generally. And people listen to me and say, "What, are you crazy?" But no, I think there's a Democrat disadvantage. Just in terms of the NRA is powerful in a lot of Democrat districts, there are many Democrat representatives who do not want to upset the NRA, and I'm going to say more about that in just a second as to why. But to resist things like a background fixing the background check system, I think that's really difficult political sell. I mean, unless if the rationale is we won't do this unless there's also some sort of a ban. The problem is the Republicans can go ahead and take a vote on fixing the background check, and Democrats will be forced to vote against it.
Now, before we move on, I just wanted to point out on the other side of things, the House actually passed a bill along these lines, but they included with it something that they desperately want, a reciprocal recognition of concealed carry from other states. And so that's sort of what the Republicans are trying to tie on to it, and which is a common thing for both parties. You have something that everyone seems to be in agreement on, and you put your own little policy preference on there, and the other side you're hoping has to sort of hold their nose and vote with it to get that. So
yeah, you know. And I say, you know, as much as reciprocal concealed carry, I think is probably a good idea, I think it's a bad tactic on this right now. That said, I mean, maybe it's, you know, the idea that the Senate can pull that and pass a straight background check fix. Maybe that makes it easier for some folks. But yeah, I mean, I understand why they're tying them. I don't know that, you know, again, I'm not the Speaker of the House, at least not yet. But the last piece the age restrictions, I think that's sort of a throwaway. I think most Republicans realize it's not going to do much. But at the same time, it doesn't do a whole lot to offend, you know, the NRA. That's one of those kind of giveaways that I can see being part of the deal. Maybe down the line, if they, you know, they're not going to give on assault weapons, they may give on the age. What else was it that?
The public meeting thing, and it seems to me you know, he did that on immigration, and I saw Democrats being people in my party being very excited about this and happy, but I would say, remember what happened on immigration. You know, I think Donald Trump plays to his audience and likes to, you know, wrong foot people and so forth, but he's also shockingly easy to manipulate for a president of the United States. And so I would expect something similar to this that we saw in immigration on guns. And so for people who are expecting something big to happen, something great in the president's words, I wouldn't hold your breath, because I think the NRA, the Republican strategy in general, is to sort of stall and wait for the public furor and outrage to die down, as it always has, and hope that kind of Democrats will take away your guns message will get them more votes than the sort of Republicans won't act in the face of gun violence message that Democrats will be putting out there. And I think
based on one of the Democrat proposals is to take away your guns. So,
well, I mean, some Democrats are proposing that, sure, and some Republicans are proposing some draconian things too. But I think for the most part, that there aren't really, you can't really find any mainstream Democrats proposing to take away guns that people have. Most of these proposals involve around making it more difficult to get certain types of weapons for certain people.
Sure. And the last point that I lost my train of thought on was the due process comment. And I think what he was referring to there is the Marco Rubio bill proposal, which I you know, like a whole lot. I think it'd be better, a lot more effective if done at the state level. But of having these firearm protection orders, essentially, that would allow someone to go to court to get an order to have someone stripped of their guns if they have them, and to put them on a no-buy list. And there's a lot of variations on this, and I think that you could do this with the proper due process protections. You could do it with the enough privacy protections. Again, court records can be sealed and so forth. And typically, I mean, I think maybe what Trump was talking about, a lot of times the way these types of hearings work, protective order hearings, is someone goes to court and says, someone is, you know, has threatened to kill me. It's, you know, whatever, my ex-husband or my ex-boyfriend, and I need a protective order. And the typical statutes, the way these work, is you can do that in what's called an ex parte hearing, which means it's just you, nobody else, and the court will issue the order. But the court then sets a hearing within, typically it's 2 weeks is the time period, where both sides get to be there and have a full hearing on the merits. I think that's what Trump was referring to in the skip the due process while the due process later. Now that, I mean, in the Trumpian world, or he could have just meant something else entirely bizarre. But I think that's sort of a standard thing in most kind of domestic violence protection orders and any other sort of protective orders, is you get that ex parte hearing, which is sort of a minimal threshold for the court to issue an order. And then there is a adversarial hearing, you know, within a couple weeks.
Yeah. And we've actually talked about that that sort of proposal before, the gun violence restraining order thing. And I think I agree with you that that could be a very good thing to do. And I also think that it's probably something that's best done at the state level. And, you know, that at the state level thing, I wanted to ask you about something, a comment you made. You said that you thought that the reciprocal concealed carry thing would be perhaps a good idea. And I'm wondering, though, isn't it kind of a fundamental right of the states to make these decisions about public safety? And as a conservative, aren't you a bit uncomfortable with the idea of the federal government sort of forcing states to recognize, you know, that particular provision?
Well, we do have a full faith and credit clause, though, too. And this is a concern of someone who is, you know, carrying on their person in their car, and they're driving through one state, they drive into another, and all of a sudden they're in violation of the law where they weren't, and then they cross another state border and they're okay again. That's the concern, is that sort of patchwork sort of idea for people who are traveling. And I think you could write a reciprocal law that protects that, but does not override a state's would not, for example, import one state's version of concealed carry to another. For example,
but wouldn't it essentially then make all states concealed carry? If you had permission from one, say, very gun permissive state, that would essentially mean that you could go to that state and you would be able to legally carry a concealed weapon in opposition to the law that was passed by the democratically elected representatives of that state.
I think to a certain extent, yes.
And I think again, that's full faith and credit only doesn't apply to everything, and it never has. It applies certainly to certain policy issues, but never to major things that impact sort of the fundamental policy decisions of the state. Things like, for instance, you can think of speed limits, or you can think of, I was thinking of another thing, drinking age, those sort of things, you know. And public safety has long been considered, you know, a clear purview of the states. And that's one of this, you know, I would say bedrock beliefs in terms of a federalist system, is that the states get to make these public safety decisions. And it's only under very unusual circumstances that the federal government is allowed to sort of step in there and tell states that they can, you know, have to do certain things along those lines.
Well, there's also an argument, I think, under the Commerce Clause. Under uniformity.
Wow, you're sounding like a Democrat here. Use the Commerce Clause to get the federal government to impose things on the states.
I'm just telling you the way it is,
sure.
And it's out there. Look, do I think there would be federalism concerns? I suppose, but I think it could be crafted in such a way that, for example, you're still going to have protections if, for example, a state says it allows a private property owners to opt out of concealed carry and say no concealed carry here. I don't think you would win a case saying, oh, I'm allowed to do that in some other state, but I'll walk into your business even though you don't allow it here and your state doesn't. I think that wouldn't hit full faith and credit, but I think protection from criminal prosecution for possession, and carrying on your person, I think would. But those are, I mean, it's sort of hypothetical at this point because it's not, I don't think it's going to happen either way. I think that if there is a bill, that comes out.
Yeah. Well, a couple other things before we move on. One, just quickly, that issue of law enforcement incompetence, it seems odd in recent years, or I guess in the last year, Republicans have been the party that have been more eager, I would say, to question the competence of law enforcement, which is a huge change. And, you know, I talked to a former police officer for many, many years, who actually ended up getting a PhD in criminal justice and now teaches policing and so forth at the college level. And I asked him, so what do you think about this incompetence issue? Because in my view, in a lot of other areas of government that I've studied, the issue isn't so much incompetence, but it's people who are just incredibly overworked and overburdened, who simply don't have the resources to do what the law is asking them to do. And so often Congress passes laws that impose huge burdens on various levels of government or state governments pass these laws as well, but they don't follow that up with the necessary resources. And he told me, no, that was his experience, certainly both as a practitioner and as somebody who studied this academically. And you know, that's what I've heard from a lot of folks. And so it's easy to say, well, there was incompetence and certain things should have been done that weren't done. And I agree with that. It seems that's almost incontrovertible, but the question is why? And it's more often than not, it's not because these are bad, stupid, evil, incompetent people we have working in law enforcement or for the FBI. It's because they just have so much on their plate and there aren't enough of them, or they don't have the resources to do the job we're asking them to do. And I think it's unfair to criticize them, to question their competence if we're not giving them the tools to do their job.
Well, I'll respond to that with, they got phones. That was the big tool that was needed in this case. They've got phones and they have access to a phone books. And if you want to say, you know, I think there's an argument to be made about leadership and priorities at organizations, because, you know, to some extent, resources flow where the priorities flow. But other parts, I mean, I don't know what else you can call it when the sheriff's deputy stands outside.
Well, that's
the
different.
School shooting,
that's different.
While it's going on, and the tools he needed, he had a gun. He had it. The reports that there were multiple sheriff's deputies who were there assigned. When the sheriff's department receives all these calls and doesn't do something, now again, you can argue, well, maybe there wasn't much they can do because they didn't have a legal basis to charge him. I think that's sort of a jump ball there. I think maybe they probably did, based on some of the reports of things that he had said and things he had said online. But they certainly had the resources to go out and visit with him and talk with him and say, hey, what's going on? What are you doing?
Maybe they did. Maybe right. This is my point. I think we're looking at this in isolation, saying as if this was the one thing that they had to do and they didn't do it. And I'm not saying that. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there might not have been incompetence. What I'm saying is, what's the context of how many calls they get about this sort of thing? You know, what's the overall work environment? And I think what we're seeing here, and just like what we see in so many other instances, is a rush to judgment. And I mean, there are going
what?
To be there
no,
are there are no.
You mean,
let
look,
me
it
finish.
Was fair to say, as a rush to judgment 2 weeks ago, but
no, I think no. I think you're so impatient. My gosh, proper investigations of this, thorough, rigorous investigations, take time. And the question that I have, and the question that's not being, it seems to me, asked by anyone except for the investigators, and they're doing stuff behind the scenes, thankfully, is that, you know, what is the resource level and how many calls of this nature do they get? And is it reasonable for us to expect that they follow up in a certain way on every one of these calls? And those are questions that, and if those questions are answered saying, well, yes, they had the resources to do this and they just didn't do it, then yeah, it's incompetence. But before I come to that conclusion, I want an actual investigation. I want somebody to look through this stuff as opposed to just some talking head saying, oh, well, it's incompetent. They should have done this or that. I don't know why they didn't. You know, that to me seems completely unfair to law enforcement.
Well, I'm fine to wait. But again, I think enough of the facts have come in at this point to indicate there is an issue. Whether it is, in your case, you think underfunding, essentially.
Maybe.
Or,
I don't know.
Or something else, then, I mean, we'll find out. But I think, I mean, can we agree that the agencies did not perform as we would have expected them to?
Yes, absolutely. We can agree that with that. Absolutely. You know, one more thing before we move on. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Georgia's Republican legislature, their recent move to strip out a jet fuel tax exemption for Delta that was presumably worth right around $50 million or so in retribution for Delta ending a promotion that offered NRA members a discount to the NRA's national convention this May. Now, Delta says at this point, only 13 people had taken advantage of the discount, and their CEO said that the company was doing this because they were ending group discounts for what they called politically divisive organizations. And just any thoughts on that, Jay?
I think well, Delta made a bad decision. Once you start playing that game, and it's happening more and more frequently with corporate America essentially weighing in on politics and political issues, they ought to expect that sort of thing. So I'm not a big believer. I think the boycott of these, or the putting pressure on these companies because they offer some sort of discount to whatever 13 NRA members, that's pretty ridiculous. And no matter what you think of the NRA, look, they are an organization that's been out there for hundreds of years. 160-ish years. There are many people who belong to it. There's a lot of things that the AARP stands for that I disagree with. I think they've done horrible things that, creating our debt society and our debt time bomb, essentially, that's going to be a tremendous problem. But I'm not advocating that companies stop, allowing AARP discounts. That's up to them.
And obviously, it was a business
decision.
When companies
want to play politics, businesses want to play it both ways. If you want to put on your helmet and put on the pads and get on the field, you have to expect that you're going to get hit.
Yeah. Well, I don't actually think Delta's being, playing. Well, I would say I don't think they're trying to take a liberal position or anything like that. I just think this is a common thing that businesses do when there's a controversial organization.
Oh, right,
left
right.
Or right. Business just wants to pull away from that. Now, I also want to point out
that the pressure more often comes from the left.
I think you're probably right about that. Yeah. But, there are some Democrats who are arguing that stunts like what Georgia's legislature did might affect the state's ability to attract business. Like, for instance, I believe Atlanta is one of the finalists for Amazon's second headquarters, which would be a really big deal, I assume. And you got to think that a company like Amazon would look at that and say, I don't know. But in any case,
so the Democrats are upset because the state stripped away $500 million in corporate welfare from a major corporation, and it might not be able to attract another major corporation that is trying to extract whatever it can from any cities and states. How much was it?
Only 50 million. For Delta, that's
I thought you said 500 million.
No, they probably spend $50 million in peanuts or something like that,
right.
So.
So it's not like a ton. 50 million.
Million, not billion.
Million. Right. I said million.
Okay. I thought you said billion. So,
One last thing. In exchange for Amazon, which again is sort of a company which wants to impose upon states, it's whatever its sort of values code of conduct is, which you think is really sort of bizarre. And this is completely off topic with the NRA thing, but. For example, Amazon sort of insisting upon various, gender equality laws in states that they're going to move into. Because why? Anyway, don't get me started. We can have another whole discussion on that.
But. I think it would be really great to do that because we could get into the whole sort of race to the bottom competition thing between states and cities and so forth. That we should maybe do that at some point.
Yeah.
All right. Before we get to our next story, we'd like to thank our newest supporter. That's James, who made a very generous donation to the show through PayPal. He writes, I'm happy to support the spirit behind the politics guys. As long as Mike stands up for the progressive side and calls out Jay when he falls back into conservative media talking points. So I do my best, James, but thank you so much for your support. We really do appreciate
it. Thank you, James.
Yep. And, when you make a pledge of financial support to the show, we would love to include a message from you, just like we did for James. So if there's anything you'd like us to pass along, you can. There's a space in both Patreon and PayPal to do that, or you can just send us a message at mail@politicsguys.com. And, of course, now that we're ad-free, listener support is what keeps us going. So if you'd like to join James and really all of our other great Politics Guys supporters, just go to politicsguys.com/support, or you can just go to politicsguys.com and you'll find a menu item there for support the show. Thanks very much. All right, relations between the U.S. and Russia have been seriously strained since Russia annexed the Ukraine's Crimea region back in 2014, but they took another turn for the worse this week when Russian President Vladimir Putin gave an extremely bellicose speech in which he focused on the American threat to global stability. In the speech, he outlined new weapon systems like nuclear-powered cruise missiles that would be nearly impossible for U.S. defenses to stop.
Invincible.
Invincible missiles. Now, there are not many defense experts see these weapons announcements as anything that would alter the nuclear balance of power in a significant way. And given the size of Russia's economy relative to that of the U.S., they're in no position to compete in a new arms race. But that being said, this level of animosity, which really hasn't been seen since the end of the Cold War, I would say is obviously a detriment not only to U.S.-Russia relations, but, you know, to peace and stability in general. And adding on to that, of course, are Russia's efforts to disrupt U.S. elections and create as much chaos and questioning of the legitimacy of U.S. institutions as possible. And this week, Admiral Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA and the U.S. Cyber Command, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that Russia hasn't stopped its efforts in this area, that Russia doesn't believe it's paid much of a price for what it's done already, and that he hasn't been given any additional authority to combat Russia's cyber operations. He told the committee, "We're taking steps, but we're probably not doing enough." And aside from the constant, collusion.
That's pretty fair. Any sort of agency is going to say that of,
sure,
we're doing our best, but we could do more if you give us more money. I think that's.
Well, sure. But I think this is, something pretty significant. And aside from President Trump saying no collusion again and again and again, there's been, in my view, basically no presidential leadership on this issue, which I find extremely troubling. I would expect a president from, regardless of party, when met with credible claims of hostile foreign power involvement in our elections. And there was a report, I think it was earlier this week or the week before, that 7 state systems had been hacked to one degree or another. I think the president needs to get way out in front of this thing. What do you think, Jay?
Two things. First of all, I have to take the obligatory cheap shot. There was a guy 4 or 6 years ago who said on TV, I think our biggest strategic threat in the world is Russia. And he was lampooned, saying that the 80s are calling and they want their foreign policy back.
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney said that, and the jokester was Barack Obama. And it was hilarious at the time, and the media loved it. Mitt Romney, what a fool, nostalgia for the Cold War. Secondly, I think if you look back to last year, one of the first things that Trump and the new Congress did was sanction Russia in relation to the election meddling and so forth. I suppose you could take further steps.
I think what Rogers is saying is that the sanctions really haven't, in his view, haven't really affected Russia's behavior at all. And
okay.
with elections coming up, The sense is that enough hasn't been done. And I think in terms of
that's a fair criticism to say more can be done, but to say nothing's been done or hasn't done anything.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's saying that. He said we're taking steps. We're probably not doing enough. And we're talking about, again, a hostile foreign power trying to impugn the legitimacy of our elections and our political systems. That to me strikes at the very heart of American democracy. And of course, Russia's not just doing this with the United States. Russia's been doing this with a whole bunch of other countries as well. And it makes sense because they know they can't compete with us economically or strategically. But what they can do is this sort of cyber warfare thing, which allows them to project disruption, I guess you could say, abroad in a major way.
Well, and I hesitate to say how again, if they want to make nasty social media Facebook posts and get people riled up and control Facebook. I mean, if that's all he's got,
I think the bigger problem. Yeah.
I mean, look, the actual hacking of an election system, when you're actually talking about, somehow gaining access to a Secretary of State's website or a Board of Elections or something like that, where you could actually either shut down, crash the system or change the results. Yeah. That's a tremendous problem. That sort of cyber meddling, that sort of cyber attack. cyber attacks on our other utility systems, on other corporate systems, that, you know, that sort of thing. No, that's very bad. Posting nasty Facebook stuff. What I'm saying is, I think so often the left has conflated these two threats.
Fair enough.
The one, okay. The one being bigger than the other, and the one having, you know, we have more evidence of the other. So,
yeah. Well, I think, you know, that's a great point. I think what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, even though we have, in a sense, national elections, they take place on the same day, the financing and the operating of these elections is not done by the federal government. It's done by local, state, and local governments. And this is one of these things that's horrifically, I would say, underfunded, though it makes sense because it's certainly not a glamorous thing. It's that kind of behind the scenes plumbing and infrastructure type of stuff. And we know that even, you know, very well defended, seemingly well defended systems can be vulnerable to dedicated, smart hackers. And certainly Russia has a lot of those. And so asking states to sort of manage this on their own. Again, I think it's a resource issue. This is not something that's typically a high priority. I think in large part just because elections aren't that, you know, common. I mean, they're common, but it's not like fixing potholes or doing the kind of everyday business of state and local government. And so this is an area where I think the federal government can certainly lend a lot of assistance and where I'd like to see a lot more action. And I would like to think that it's something that could be structured as bipartisan. It's not just about Russian interference. It could be about any hacker who from North Korea, from, you know, regardless. But I think the problem with the Trump administration is President Trump is scared to death, not scared to death, but President Trump feels that any sort of movement in this suggests that, well, yes, Russia helped him win the election and therefore he's not legitimate. And that's just something he's not willing to go in that direction, obviously.
He bombed Syria.
But still, I mean, he seems to be so incredibly... would he not do this otherwise,
the,
you know?
The idea...
I'm not saying it's a rational view. I'm just saying it's what he seems to think.
Well, look, I first of all agree that, look, the Russian problem is real, and I would say has been real since 1917. The idea that Trump's done nothing or somehow this points to collusion because he hasn't, you know, bombed them or something.
No, I don't believe that.
He bombed their allies.
I think he believes it.
Right. You're saying he's afraid to get tough on Russia because people might think he's colluding with Russia?
No, I think that he doesn't want to come out in front on this issue and really push hard on this issue because he feels like it's all tied in with his being persecuted for this fake news collusion story, so forth. And so anything involving Russia and elections, if he takes any kind of stance on this, it's somehow arguing
you're,
that
you're
he's,
saying he would it would like an admission of that there
exactly.
is something there.
Exactly. I
suppose I get that. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
to me, I think you can draw the line, and I think Trump is probably right that the media wouldn't draw this line though between hardening online systems that regard voting versus what do you do about, you know, Russian trolls on Facebook.
Two different issues.
Those are two different issues. One is a national security one. One is not.
Great point.
Also, just coincidentally, last night on TBS, they had the 2012 version of Red Dawn that I watched with my daughter. And I just had a wonderful time explaining to her, telling her about the 1984 version of Red Dawn. I think you and I watched that together on cable one time. And it's...
Well, I would say people calling this a new Cold War, many of those people, I would hazard to guess, were not really around for the
exactly.
old Cold War. You and I caught the tail end of it, and it was a very different feeling than this. This is, I think that's a bit of a hyperbole.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the other thing. I don't think there is any real legitimate concern, certainly not to the level of it was in the 80s, of a military conflict with the Russians.
Yeah. All right,
people should watch Red Dawn just because it's awesome.
Yes, okay. Well, you know, moving on, it's been a crazier week than usual in the West Wing. Hard to believe, but let me see if I get all this down, Jay. Okay, I'll take a deep breath. President Trump's son-in-law and top advisor, Jared Kushner, had his security clearance downgraded due to a variety of, I guess we'll call them, problematic financial entanglements with foreign investors. Trump confidant and communications director Hope Hicks resigned shortly thereafter, testifying at, shortly after she testified to the House Intelligence Committee that she sometimes told white lies for the president. Chief of Staff John Kelly, who was brought in to impose some semblance of discipline, is said to be on the outs, with sources saying that the president's letting people know that he's no longer really listening so much to his chief of staff. There are reportedly plans in the works to remove National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. The president has once again publicly berated his attorney general, calling Jeff Sessions' appointment of an inspector general to investigate possible visa abuse disgraceful, in all caps. And I think that might be it. Did I miss anything there, Jay?
You got a lot of it. You got the gist of it.
So, I mean, just to be clear here, in over a year, just a bit over a year, he's gotten rid of a chief of staff, maybe with another one on the way, I don't know, a chief strategist, two deputy chiefs of staff, a national security advisor, maybe with the second one on the way out, two deputy national security advisors, a press secretary, three communications directors, and an FBI director. I mean, wow. What do you make of this, Jay?
Well, you know, I think the first thing with this is the caveat I think we always want to add, that that both Mike and I are well read in terms of our sources. We have in some cases sources that are active in political events and that we talk to and maybe get a little insight from them. And we have sort of a long background of looking at these things and analyzing them and knowing how they go. That said, I don't know anybody in the West Wing, or have any inside insight into what's going on there any more than what, I read in the newspapers. So there's always this sort of palace intrigue stuff that the press loves, and it's hard to say what's true and what's not. What we can say, I mean, on some things, I think you can make some reasonable. I mean, I think the Hope Hicks statements about telling white lies for the president, well, that's sort of a communication director's job. I don't think anyone would dispute that. From everything that's been written, again, about her testimony, there was nothing sort of shocking or damning or would indicate that her testimony was in any way related to her deciding to leave. And you could also come up with a lot of good reasons why being communications director for Donald Trump might be a job that you might want to get out of.
And on that point, you know, also she was involved in a relationship with Rob Porter,
exactly.
Also was let go after spousal abuse claims, that sort of thing. But I agree with you in terms of what we know, as opposed to what sources have said. You know, we can certainly say that the turnover has been extraordinary, and especially in the communications area, which makes absolute sense because it's fairly clear that the president feels stifled by any sort of message discipline, and he wants to do his own thing when he wants to. And that's a real problem for the people who are trying to work closely with him to try to put, because of course, one of the jobs of senior White House staff is to craft a coherent, clear, single message.
Consistent message.
Yeah. Message discipline is huge. And it has the Trump people tearing out their hair, basically. Understandably so, I would say. And also, I would say that I get a sense, this happens in a lot of presidencies where you get this sort of bunker mentality over a time. I can't trust anyone, that sort of thing. I get a sense that there's a bit more of this earlier on in the Trump administration than maybe in other points. And I would also say, in terms of the Sessions issues, and Donald Trump has had issues with Jeff Sessions for a while now, I disagree with Jeff Sessions profoundly on almost everything related to criminal justice policy. But I also believe that Jeff Sessions is an honorable guy who, based on his ideological predispositions, says to himself, what's the right thing to do here? And then he does that thing. And the president hates that, because when the right thing is what the president doesn't want, the president just sees that as being disloyal. But in this, it seems to me that loyalty in the Trump administration is strictly a one-way street. And so he's written off Jeff Sessions, who I would say is probably one of the more honorable people in his administration, again, who I don't agree with on anything. And I just find that disgraceful in all caps.
Well, and I think first of the other piece of the Sessions things on the merits, I think there's a really good argument that Sessions is absolutely right.
Exactly.
That the better way to go about this is an inspector general's election or investigation. And because that's the inspector general's job. And the inspector general has done sort of a good job on this already. For example, finding lost emails and so forth. You know, and I also think Sessions is right politically on this, that I think it makes more sense. I think that investigation coming internally through an inspector general is going to have more credibility than sort of dueling special counsels. You know, again, I suppose you can differ with one another. I mean, I think Trump looks at it as, well, they, meaning the other side, has a special counsel. I ought to have a special counsel, too. And I think that's just sort of a bad idea, because what you end up with strategically is just sort of this, you know, he said, she said, both sides pointing fingers, and nobody ends with it. So, but that's just me talking. I think Sessions is doing the right thing on the merits and politically.
Yeah. And, you know, I think to me, the fundamental
if he isn't, the way to handle it isn't to send out a tweet. It's to pick up the phone and say, Jeff, what the hell are you doing?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. But to me, that gets to the fundamental problem, which is presidential temperament. And I don't mean being, you know, nice and diplomatic and so forth. It's just thinking in terms of, if you want to actually get things done in a policy sense, and you don't have massive majorities supporting you, like, say, you know, an FDR, an LBJ or someone like that had, there were certain temperamental qualities that are incredibly helpful, like being comfortable with ambiguity, being able to see the world from the other person's point of view, which is not to say adopting that view, being willing to compromise on certain things, being
Just also having the discipline to know that you don't have to comment on absolutely everything that comes over the transom.
Exactly.
It's okay to just not say something.
Yeah. And so
you don't
have
to tweet it.
Yeah, but apparently, you know, this president just can't help himself. And if that's one thing I would say we know for certain about Donald Trump at this point. All right, well, it's time for what we're reading, where we step back and, you know, talk about the more in-depth, thoughtful things we're reading, listening to, or watching. Jay, do you want to start us off this week?
I will, and this is probably, people would go, there he goes again. This is a commentary piece in the Wall Street Journal from February 26th, and we'll find a non-paywall link, I'm sure. And the reason, and here's the thing, it's a little weird because in rereading this now, I probably would have to backtrack, but the most important thing is it's written by Joseph Epstein.
Great.
Between one of you and I, he's an American treasure, and people don't realize, if you can find any essay, book, whatever, by Joseph Epstein, he's smart, he's funny. But it has to do with, the only good thing about Donald Trump is all his policies. And I would have agreed with this, probably before the tariff stuff, came up. But he talks about this discussion with his son. He said, the nicely formulated the problem for thoughtful conservatives. I approve of almost everything he has done, my son remarked, and I disapprove of almost everything he has said. And I think that sort of puts you know, where a lot of thoughtful conservatives were probably, again, at least pre-tariffs, that, and I guess he hasn't done it yet. He's just said it. But the idea that, look, you can have some really solid policy wins. And again, we think that the tax plan has been a big policy win. Some of the confirmations have been big policy wins. Deregulation has been a big policy win. These are things the Republicans have been looking for years and years and years. But it is always, there's always that bittersweet bit where, because it's tinged with some crazy tweet. Or it's the two steps forward, one step back, because he lacks sort of the self-discipline to control his, I don't even know what you call it, but anyway, I think it's a good read in terms of where a lot of conservatives are on Trump, that they disapprove of Trump the man, they disapprove of the silly tweets, the sort of diminishing of the presidency, boy, we wish we could get someone who could enact conservative policy, but still be a grown up.
Yeah. Well, and I would say that for my friends on the left, even though you will almost certainly not agree with Joseph Epstein's political views, he is well worth, I would read just about anything that he writes. In fact, I've actually, I'm almost embarrassed to admit, I've actually sent him fan letters, and he had emails, really, and he has responded back so incredibly graciously, and I've bought, I think, just about all of his books. He is a wonderful writer. Probably, I would say he's the greatest living American essayist. I would go that far. And so, yeah, that's a great recommendation, Jay. All right. My recommendation is a book, actually a book from someone I've talked to on the show, Larry Lessig. The book is Republic Lost, the second edition, actually. And there's a story behind this. Larry Lessig is a big proponent of campaign finance reform, arguing that the current system hurts both liberals and conservatives. It's a interesting argument. And I read his book when it first came up a number of years ago. I started using it in my class. And I noticed that this summer when I was picking books for my upcoming classes, that he had a new edition out. And I always said, I'll get the new edition and check it out. And I assigned it for my class. And now with most new editions of books, you get like a new foreword or a new afterword or a couple little things here. And that was my assumption. So I just blithely assigned it to my class, saying, well, it'll be a little updated, that kind of thing. That'll be good. And I looked, no, he rewrote like 70% of the book. It's like, oh, great. Oh, I have to redo all of my notes. I was highly pissed off at Larry Lessig for a while, but the stuff that his revisions were great revisions, very thoughtful. I really admire the fact that he didn't just try to go for a money grab by putting out a second edition. This is a true update. It's a fascinating book, whether you agree or disagree. If you want to get a really interesting look as to the reasons why maybe both the left and the right should be for some kind of reform of our campaign finance system, this is the book. It's an amazing book, and I highly recommend it.
Were any of the changes a result of your interview?
No.
He didn't mention of like after discussing with podcast host Michael Baranowski, I've changed my mind.
Well, that was actually after I talked to him after the second one came out, but maybe gotcha. In the third edition, he'll incorporate
some
of
that. He's working on it now.
Exactly. All right. Well, you know, Jay, I realize that we're at the end of today's episode, and there's something that we haven't done.
Uh-oh, what's that?
Yeah, well, we haven't interrupted the show to pitch razors or meal delivery or ticket services or really anything. And you know why that is?
Why, Mike?
Because we're completely ad-free. We know that's what listeners want. But of course, the only way we can do that is with your support. Now, there are plenty of ways you can support the show, and a lot of them don't involve giving us any money at all. You can, of course, give us money. We love
that.
Not to
discourage that, yeah.
Yeah, go to politicsguys.com/support. That's a direct link. Or just go to politicsguys.com and go to support in the main menu or click on the PayPal or Patreon links you'll see there. But also, subscribing to the show really helps, as does sharing episodes. And you can also leave reviews, ratings of the show on iTunes, or just get in touch with us. You know, if you got a question, comment, correction, you know where to reach us at this point. mail@politicsguys.com. There's our Facebook page where you can message us, and we post stuff throughout the week. That's facebook.com/politicsguys page. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us.